The problem with work is it's lonely.
My name's Julia, and I'm one of the producers for The New Way We Work. So many years back, when I had just finished a graduate program in journalism, one of my first jobs was working on a podcast, and we had a pretty small production team, all in office, of course, in New York, because this was before the pandemic. And like me, a lot of my coworkers had moved to the city for school or for jobs in journalism. And we had a boss who was very fond of telling us that we were all like family. And there were ways that it was very family-like. My office friends became some of my closest friends. I would spend all day G-chatting with them. And people would like go to each other's birthday parties. Sometimes our boss would even bring in leftover food from home and then leave it out for people to eat on the communal table. We were probably too close. There was at least one in-office relationship. Whenever there was like a conflict between people, it felt impossible to avoid because the team was so small and we didn't really have any separate rooms. But when I left that job, I started freelancing and realized how lonely and isolating it felt. I really missed my office friends, and I realized that making friends through work or school was basically all I'd ever done. And now I'm working full-time again. I have work friends and non-work friends, partially just from living here longer. Things are a lot more balanced. So work is not a family for sure, but we still like share a lot of snacks.
This is Fast Company's The New Way We Work, where we take listeners on a journey through the changing landscape of our work lives and explain exactly what we need to build the future we want. I'm Fast Company Deputy Editor Kathleen Davis. As Julia experienced in her old job, leaders have tried to sell work as one big family for years. With the proliferation of office besties and work spouses and the blurring between work and home, many employees view work as a type of family too. But anyone who's been passed over for a promotion they deserved or laid off after years of hard work knows that work isn't your family. Work can make people lonely by preventing them from connecting with their community, or loneliness might come from too few workplace connections if you're freelancing like Julia was, or just in a job without that many peers. Some mental health experts have even called loneliness a health epidemic. So how can we prioritize our mental health and ambition at the same time? How can we feel less alone at work and foster meaningful relationships while still protecting our real lives? And how can we take this crisis and turn it into an opportunity to feel seen and heard? To help me explore those answers is Anne Shokit. Anne is the former editor-in-chief of 17 Magazine, author of The Big Life, A Guide for Career-Driven Young Women, and CEO of The List, a private community of innovators across media, technology, entrepreneurship, and business. Anne, thank you so much for being here.
What an amazing opportunity. I'm so glad we're having this conversation today.
There's so much we can get into here, but I will start with kind of the big and most shocking headline. You've mentioned that nearly 80% of white-collar employees say that they felt lonely because of their job. Can you go into more detail on why that is?
Isn't that stunning? A year ago, we did the first research trying to identify what the problem with loneliness is. Why are we lonely in the workplace? And we heard from people that they are isolated, unsupported. They feel like their companies don't want to help them succeed. They feel disconnected. They feel overwhelmed. And all of this is creating a really toxic challenge in the workplace. And it's not just a mental health challenge. This is a pipeline problem. It is preventing women from moving up into positions of greater power and influence because it gets lonelier as you get more senior for women. It is an equality problem. We heard from people of color that they felt they couldn't show up into the workplace and be their authentic selves. And it's a next generation problem because the loneliness is even worse when you're early in your career. You just haven't had enough time to build up the relationships that you need to succeed. You know, we're talking about the great resignation that we're still wrestling with, and we're talking about the pandemic. All of that is in the background that is keeping us from making meaningful connections.
So you mentioned women, especially, and women at the top, especially, and I know that a lot of your work focuses on women, especially young women at work. How is loneliness at work different for women than it is for men?
I want to be clear up front. This is not a men versus women problem. This is not a next generation versus senior leadership problem. Everybody, nearly 80% of people in corporate jobs are lonely because of their job. However, my particular wedge into this problem is to focus on women because I've devoted my entire career to helping women step into their power, both personally and professionally. And so what's interesting is the way that loneliness impacts women is different than the way it impacts men or the way it's driven. And so for women, it's driven by a feeling of isolation, right? Of feeling that you don't belong, that you're unsupported. For men, it's driven by a lack of respect. And that respect for both the people above them and the people below them. And actually, what's interesting is this year, we focused on how to find the solutions to loneliness in the workplace, the togetherness. Why is it so hard to unlock togetherness? And it turns out the same difference in what drives loneliness is the same difference of what drives togetherness for men versus women. Women want to feel psychological safety in the workplace, and men want to feel respected and seen. And so the problem is massive, and everybody needs to do their piece for it. But it's really important to make sure that you are tailoring the solutions so that everybody can be a part of it.
So I want to break down kind of from both perspectives then, from the employee perspective and from the management perspective, kind of how to address these. But I know that you've put some research into this and you have some ideas in place. Tell me about the 10 minutes of togetherness and kind of the micro habits that help people build that support system.
Isn't this amazing? So the Surgeon General's report came out last year on loneliness, and it showed this massive decline over 20 years of the time we spent together. But if we each spent 10 minutes a day intentionally building our connections and nurturing our networks, 10 minutes a day, we would decrease that loneliness gap by 50%. And we saw that in our research. I want to take one quick moment and to thank my amazing research partners, because one of the important things here is gratitude and collaboration and partnership. And the List partnered with BSG for our research and Berlin Cameron, and we could not have done this without them. And what we found in the research is that 1 in 3 people in the workplace, just 1 in 3, are more likely to feel connected and less likely to be lonely. We call these people the cultivators. And the cultivators do just as it says. They cultivate their networks, but it's not corporate retreats. It's not boozy cocktail hours. It's not golf outings. It's literally tiny habits during the workday that they regularly flex these muscles to build the connections. And they're tiny. They are sending a text message to let somebody know that you see them and appreciate them. They are check-ins. They are walking around the office. They are acknowledging the humanity in their coworkers. Hey, I saw that amazing thing you did last week. You should come join this meeting. Your name came up in a meeting and I let them know that you are responsible for this. Hey, I've got a spot on my team. Would you come join us to give us your point of view? All of that kind of seeing the humanness in your coworkers is really important. They also have really diverse networks. It's not just the 3 people on their team. It is previous bosses and previous reports. It's staying in touch with folks that they met earlier on in their career, or people that they meet at an industry event and staying in touch with them lightly, right? A light touch in every couple of weeks, every couple of months. But that diversity of your network, collaboration, and tiny little micro habits is what the individual can do for their 10 minutes a day.
Those micro habits make so much sense when you talk about it, because it is true. You know, I think a lot of companies are like, okay, we need to foster this company culture and all of these things. And so they have this forced fun, right? The like come in and do these forced fun things and it backfires. But just that like little moment of I'm going to, and I always say to myself, like, if you have a good thought about somebody, don't keep it to yourself. So many times like, oh, that was really great what she did, but I'm not like actually saying it out loud. It's like just those like acknowledgements really do go a long way to for people to feel like, as you say, the humanness in the people that you work with.
Well, it's really important when you talk about corporate culture, because it is an equally shared responsibility to tackle loneliness between the individuals in building their networks, but for the company to come to the table with the ability to do so, right? With permission and opportunity. And I'll tell you what one of the biggest surprises in the research was for me, the all hands meeting. Everybody, right, you left. Everybody wants to roll their eyes at the all hands meeting. It's performative, it's a drag, it's a waste of time. But it turns out that the all hands meeting is actually one of the important keys for creating a corporate culture of visibility, of appreciation, of diversity, of collaboration. And it's creating a transparency, right? It's creating this moment, a regularly occurring moment for people to see each other. And so every time you want to roll your eyes and think like, what a drag this all hands meeting is, it's actually core to building connection. Now, it's the ground floor. This is not the only thing that companies should do to foster a connection in the workplace, but it's the first step.
When we're talking about connection, when we're talking about loneliness, should we be bringing more of our true selves to work? That's a refrain we hear a lot about bringing your whole self to work. Should we expect more of work? Should work be a family?
So families are messy. And there's a lot of shenanigans that happen in families. And that's not exactly what you want your workplace to feel like. In fact, I think a lot of times people say, we're a family here, when they mean the workplace. And I think that's a red flag, right? You're going to ask too much of me, expect too much of me. So I actually don't think your work should be your family. However, there's a nugget in there that you don't want work to be a totally siloed experience, right? You don't want to feel like you're just a cog in the wheel going in, filing reports, having 12 Zoom calls a day, and there's been zero human interaction. And so there's a middle ground where you can have meaningful connection, meaningful togetherness with the folks that work with you, for you, around you, and without feeling like they're encroaching on your personal space or that it's too messy.
When you talk about that and when I think about it, it reminds me of, we have a longtime contributor, Art Markman, who's a psychology professor. And he mentioned once like the different kind of relationships you have, and he related it to neighbors. And I think like that, you know, like the people you work with are not acquaintances or strangers, but they're not your family. They're this other kind of middle ground relationship where it's like, you know, your neighbors fairly well. You would, you know, help them out if you need to, sort of, you have that kind of like middle close relationship. You know, family will hopefully love you on the other side, be with you unconditionally, and work is kind of not so much like that.
I think that's right. And, you know, we have this amazing advisor to the 10 Minutes to Togetherness program, whose name is Daisy Ogie Dominguez, who wrote a book called The Inclusion Revolution. And Daisy talks about these moments of celebration in the workplace or moments of care, right? And so it's, and they're personal. It's birthdays. It's acknowledging when someone has had a loss in their life. It is the kinds of things that you would do in a family. It is showing that kind of gentleness and generosity and care. And that goes a long way towards building trust and belonging and connection. We saw it again and again in the research. It was hard personal moments or beautiful personal moments that were acknowledged in the workplace. That is what people are looking for. They want to feel seen and celebrated and cared for.
I think all of that is so true. And I think it is, you know, so much gets underestimated how much those acknowledgments matter and mean to an employee and can make a difference between feeling connected and disconnected, lonely and not lonely. If you're an employee and you're listening to this and you're, you know, part of that 80% that feels lonely and disconnected at work and maybe undervalued and unappreciated and all those things that go with it, how can you advocate for yourself or like help change your own company culture that maybe is flawed in this way?
You know, there's a lot of things that you can do that are not about your company culture, right? That there are things that you need to do that you're bringing to the space. And so one is to deepen your relationship with yourself, right? And to think about how else can you shore up your support outside of the workplace. We talk about meditating. We talk about self-care, but I don't mean self-care like get a manicure. I mean self-care like paying attention to your boundaries. My boundaries are my self-care. About spending time deepening the relationship with yourself so you have something to give in the workplace. And then I'm a big fan of the check-in. And it's a really simple ritual that I do every morning. I spend my 10 minutes in the morning reaching out intentionally to a couple of people that I want to stay connected to. And sometimes it's a social media post, right? There's a lot of things that are happening. We're all very fast. I'm sending a note. This is amazing. This makes me think about the last time. Is there anything I can do to help you? Please let me know if I can bring something to bear to this conversation, right? That check-in piece. There's each of these elements. How are you deepening your relationship with yourself? How are you deepening your relationships with the network around you? And then how are you showing up into the office, right? How are you acknowledging the collaboration and transparency that you want to see in the rest of your life with the rest of your employees? And then there's the employer piece. And how can you, without adding more work to your plate, without taking on unpaid labor in the workplace, but what is the piece of responsibility that you can do to create this culture of connection? Is it lunch? Is it coffee? Is it inviting people into a meeting, right? And then maybe it's about bubbling up an idea to management. Hey, we've been having healthy lunches to support each other in our own self-care. I wonder if this would be a great idea for the company to take on and support us once a month. We don't want to put all of the responsibility on the employees or the individuals of changing their entire workplace culture, but you can take these micro steps in your own life and hope that they bubble up into the bigger picture.
When you mentioned setting boundaries, that makes me think obviously of work-life balance, which is a giant topic. And you had a really provocative quote from your book, The Big Life. You said, "Work-life balance is a sham. It doesn't exist, and I don't think it should. There is no point where work ends and life begins. It's all work all the time and all life all the time. What you want to do for a living, to feel like an actual living, and that's the magic trick." So to me, when I read that it sounded a lot like this term that we heard for a while, work-life integration, which I'm sure you've heard. The idea that there shouldn't be this kind of hard line separation between work and personal life, that they both kind of blend together. For a lot of people, though, especially in the last couple of years, they've been advocating for, as you said, boundaries and that separation, and they want to be able to feel disconnected and offline from work. What's your stance and your viewpoint on the whole work-life balance, work-life integration, the lines between the two?
So I'll tell you, thank you so much for bringing up my book, The Big Life. I wrote that book, Peak Hustle Culture. It was a guide for millennial women into the next phase of their life as they were putting together their career, their partnerships, their idea of what a big life is. And the big life is life on your own terms. Now, all life, all the time, was that energy, that like pre-pandemic, let's make something happen. You've got a job and a side hustle and another gig, right? You've got like big dreams. That's where that book fit in. I think we're in a different place now, frankly. I think that I don't even think we're at work-life integration. I do think work-life balance is a sham, but I also at the same time think that my boundaries are my self-care. The things I say no to are just as important as the things I say yes to. However, the title of that chapter that you pulled that quote from is Embrace the Mess. And that is a mantra that still rings true now and that I continue to live by, which is life is a mess. We didn't know we were going to have a pandemic and we had to figure it out. We had to figure out how we were going to work, how we were going to take care of our children, and how we were going to keep our careers moving forward, right? And even now, as people are getting past the great resignation and thinking about what are the jobs. And frankly, there's a lot of contraction in so many industries. Like all of that is a mess. And so you have to deal with it all the time. We've gotten much better. Frankly, this is, I think, I dare to say, one of the benefits of the pandemic, that it taught us that nobody has it all siloed and perfect, right? We were seeing into each other's lives, kids running into Zooms and dinner that was on the stove during an end of the day meeting, laundry, piles of laundry. We've gotten better at like positioning our Zoom cameras so you can, like, the laundry and the mess is just off camera. But we were able to like really look at the fallacy of everything being siloed and perfectly tucked away in like tiny little bento boxes of our life. I think the mess is your mojo, right? That mess is keeping you moving forward. And it's the energy, and you have to figure out work and life and kids and love and partnership all together.
Yeah, that boundaries as self-care, I think you're exactly right. There has been a big shift pre-pandemic to now and hustle culture, and that kind of was. And you know, a lot of your work is around women and ambition, and that's a topic I'm very interested in as well. And we explored kind of the evolution of ambition across generations of women with our Ambition Diary series a few years ago. And something that I observed both in that series and with trends that we've seen like quiet quitting is that everyone, but maybe especially people of color, maybe especially women, especially the younger generation, have kind of this different relationship with ambition than peak hustle culture millennials maybe had, and even generations before that. It's kind of this rebellion against the idea of the corporate ladder. What have you observed about kind of the evolution of ambition, and what do you think the future of ambition is?
I am always learning from the next generation. I am solidly Gen X, and we came up in this culture of never let them see you sweat and put your head down and do the work. And I would walk into corporate meetings, even when the numbers were bad and things were falling apart, I would call it the AM show, catch show. Oh, everything's great. Don't look over here. Look at these amazing things we've done. What I'm so inspired by is this next generation of workers that doesn't have time for any of that spin. They want to say, look, things are not great. How are you going to help me? How are we going to do this together? Or you're asking too much for me. That is an impossible scenario. Those metrics by which you're judging my success are not my metrics. I bring value here, and we need to work together to find what are the metrics. And so I learned the power of community from millennials. I learned around my dining room table by bringing together, you know, I did a series of dozens of pizza dinners, pizza and rosé around my dining room table. And I could see how important the connections were between these millennial women at my table. And they were learning from each other rather than seeking outside mentorship. I never had that coming up in my career. And for Gen Z to say, quiet quitting, I'm going to do what the letter of my job is because you're not paying me more. You're not bringing me more. And to put up some real boundaries around hustle culture and to say, if you want more, I will give you more, but you have to pay me for it. I think that that's really actually quite inspiring.
Yeah. As a geriatric millennial myself, I find a lot of inspiration in Gen Z and how they're kind of, as you say, like calling BS on a lot of the things that we were just like, we just have to do this. We have to, you know, and kind of calling BS, I think, on the idea of a corporate ladder too, that ambition has to be competitive. I do think that there's a lot of, you know, and we're seeing this even in like labor organizing, there's a lot of community, as you say, and collective power rather than, you know, everybody for themselves and what can you achieve?
You know, I think that we would believe in the ladder if the ladder worked, you know, and I think that people aren't staying at jobs for long periods of time for their careers because the jobs aren't keeping them there. We used to say, well, they don't want to pay their dues, but why would they pay their dues? Because they're going to get laid off in a couple of years anyway, right? We want to blame, we want to point blame at the next generation. But the next generation is just looking ahead at the folks ahead of them, and they're trying to learn from those lessons. And I think they're looking ahead at the ladder. They're saying, man, it's lonely at the top. Why would I want to spend my career trying to get to that room, to that corner office, if I'm going to be alone there, isolated, unsupported, and then all of that is going to spill over into my private life and start to fray the relationships around me? No, thank you.
And yeah, that really goes, you know, full circle to what we were talking about at the beginning of feeling so isolated, and then that kind of false bill of goods of, but work is your family, but the company doesn't love you back. They can lay you off at a moment's notice. So really what matters is those connections that you make and the you know, community and that you build within the people that won't hopefully lay you off and forget about you.
Well, do you take those connections with you? right? That's the one piece that makes it a little bit layoff proof, a little bit recession proof, is that you're going to take those connections and that those relationships and those micro habits of practicing building those connections, all of that goes with you and will help you into the next phase of your career or the next job or the next entrepreneurship moment. I'm seeing so many women step into entrepreneurship, probably because the ladder is broken and they think that they don't want to be isolated and lonely at the very top. But having flexed those muscles and built that strength on the way up is really important.
So you mentioned a little bit, you know, you touched on a little bit that loneliness manifests itself differently in different stages of your life or in different stages of your career or for different people. I'm wondering, can you walk me through kind of what it looks like as an entry-level employee, maybe like a mid-manager level employee and like, you know, the cliche, it's lonely at the top. Like what does loneliness look like and what do those, you know, kind of stages of your career need differently?
What we need is community and connection, but it looks different at every stage in your career. So let me start at the top. So I run a community called The List, and it is a small curated network of high impact women and non-binary leaders who are at the top of their field. And what this group of women who are at the very top need is support and connection with other people who are going through the same things that they are going through. The stresses that they have in their work life, in their personal life, in the ways that they want to get paid. They need some transparency about who's getting paid what and how do I ask for this, right? They want to be in community with other people who are operating at that level. When I saw millennial women come around my table and the kind of camaraderie that they need was very much about, how do I find a partner who honors my ambition? How do I get my boss to respect me, right? It was much more about that early and middle career moment in their lives. And so Gen Z, I think, will also need a different kind of connection. They need somebody who's going to help them get their foot in the door. I will never forget when I was early in my career and I was desperately looking for a job. And I turned to a senior woman in journalism. And she said to me, what, you don't know anybody? Like, you can't just call, she's like, just call this person and ask them if they're hiring. I remember feeling so small, like there was something wrong with me that I didn't know anybody. And so for all of those people who are just starting out in your career, first of all, it's okay not to know anybody. Second of all, it's not okay if you say, if somebody says to you, oh, you should know so-and-so, you don't know them. And they don't follow up with saying, I will introduce you. That to me is the worst sin that we can commit in community building. If you want somebody to know somebody, you have to make the connection. And if anybody ever says you should know somebody and they don't, cross them off your list. They're never going to be helpful. So at each stage of your career, absolutely, you need a different kind of community, but you need community.
So it sounds like, you know, if I'm paraphrasing that, you know, early in your career, you need those folks that will help you make those connections. In the middle of your career and in the top of your career, what you need is kind of the same, but there may be different people, but peers. You need, you know, community and peer help of like, here's, you know, here's how I'm dealing with this. Like, I'm dealing with the same thing. I, you know, we can commiserate or we can give advice on like, you know, how we're dealing with the same things.
And it would be amazing if it was an outside community that you could find where you felt supported and connected, but it's just as valuable if it's your group text and you never get off your couch.
Yeah. I mean, you need that, like, you know, somebody, a sounding board, somebody, a gut check, like, this is happening. Has this happened to you? Yes, it has. Like, at least we're in it together. This is how I handled this. Or, you know, I love the like, it would be good if it's somebody outside of your company, especially when you're trying to, like, suss out pay and, like, am I being, you know, paid fairly? Am I being treated fairly? Those sorts of things. Yeah.
That's really important that if you can tap into a community that's diverse so that you're not feeling like you're in competition for jobs and you can tap into other experiences that are not your own, that is deeply valuable in building community. It's one of the things that we've really paid attention to at The List is making sure that we are diversifying the industries and the experiences so that everybody can help each other. It really takes away any kind of competition or barriers.
We covered on a recent episode kind of how work isn't always a meritocracy and how, you know, the what helped you succeed in school does not always help you succeed in the office. Surprise, surprise. What kind of advice or what do entry-level employees kind of need to realize is different between going in from a like an educational environment to a work environment?
I heard that episode. I loved it. Because especially as sort of that school overachiever, right? The things that helps you get good grades are not the things that are going to help you succeed in the workplace. I'll tell you, the collaboration that you learn in school, the group projects are so important to changing the dynamics of the workplace. And we kept seeing it again and again in our research that it was collaboration and transparency. And those are, in all candor, newer ideas in corporate. And so I don't want to tell the next generation of folks who are just coming out of college and new to the workplace that they have to get in line and follow our rules. I actually think that they have a responsibility to help us and help move us along towards greater collaboration and transparency, the kinds of things that helped them succeed in college.
That's so true. Well, Anne, thank you so much for being here. This has been such a great conversation.
It is my pleasure. Thank you so much for shining a light on such an important topic. It's something we all have a responsibility to address.
And that's all for this episode. If you're a new listener, be sure to subscribe to The New Way We Work wherever you listen. And if you like this episode, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And we want to hear from you. Work is changing every day. What's the most pressing issue on your mind? Email us at podcasts@fastcompany.com. The New Way We Work is produced by Julia Hsu, Avery Miles, Blake Odom, and Joshua Christensen, with editing by Nicholas Torres.